Right, change of transportation, well, not transportation mode, change of mode, industry completely. We now have Dr. Melinda Lyons, who is the human factors lead from the response unit. And I have to ask, what does MPSA stand for, Melinda?
That's the National Patient Safety Agency.
There we go. National Patient Safety Agency. So over to Melinda.
Thank you, Anne. Anne actually asked if she would do the my previous biography or I should do it, and I thought with the number of pilots in the room, this would give me ample chance to duck when I admit I used to be Eurocontrol. So yes, I was formerly in offshore oil and gas, then air traffic management before I came to healthcare, and I've worked in a variety of spheres in healthcare like surgery, emergency departments and anaesthesia. So thank you for inviting me. With the title of the conference as it was, I have to feel, you know, a little bit like an imposter, but being that this conference perhaps so far should be renamed the Jim Rees and Appreciation Society, perhaps not. So you might notice that the title of my presentation has changed a bit from what's in the programme, and really we have Jim to blame for that too, being that I can say that he's not here. Jim has actually provided us with most of our human factors training, and if you would want a great sort of frontline staff, generic, covers lots of people and really sort of reaches out people, we have a program called Foresight, and we have DVDs and everything, and it might be really nice for you to at least have a look at it and see if it will work in your industries. So I'm not going to talk about that today because I knew I wouldn't be able to do it justice with Jim. So I have to say I sympathise with what Malcolm was saying earlier and being this sort of laggard in safety, because healthcare is so often considered behind all the rest of you. We're always looking up to you as the sort of high reliability industries and, you know, what we can learn. And sometimes, obviously, with my background, I can say sometimes it isn't actually that great, but compared to healthcare, it often is. But so I wanted to talk rather than being apologetic, I wanted to talk about really some quite positive aspects and where we've got to in healthcare. So I'm going to be talking about the National Reporting and Learning Service. I'll explain a bit later why that's different to the National Patient Safety Agency. As you can probably gather, it's going to be political. So I want to talk a bit about how it works, what we're achieving with, and really a bit about how healthcare is different, or maybe how you can learn from healthcare for your own industries. So the background of why we exist. Today you could almost wonder why there was ever a question of the idea of patient safety and whether it was relevant or useful. I mean, thankfully the MP's expenses scandal has actually pushed headlines like this off the front pages, but in terms of competitiveness, we know we actually beat all industries in terms of media coverage, so we're at least winning on that one. So traditionally, professionalism in healthcare, like many of the rest of your industries, was considered sufficient to police the system. And obviously, there came to be sort of documents such as these that pointed out that actually that wasn't enough. Most obvious difference between industries is that our sector is concerned with the organic. We haven't pre-designed people the way we might have done to make them easier to fix, the way we could with an aircraft. And obviously, it's the case that fundamentally, death is an inevitable result of life, and therefore sometimes you can't say whether it occurred due to poor care or delayed care or whether it actually was inevitable, which makes it very fuzzy in how you judge poor performance and actually criminal or violation acts. And obviously public curiosity has opened the whole can of worms, which means it's very much open to public scrutiny. And this is really how the reporting and learning system and how the NRLS actually came to being. Just to alleviate the confusion now, what used to be called the National Patient Safety Agency is now called the National Reporting and Learning System within the National Patient Safety Agency. Basically, it became merged with the National Research Ethics Service, which looks at the ethics of clinical trials and research studies, and the National Clinical Assessment Service, which looks at, that's, if you like, the more punitive side of what we do, and that would look at clinical staff and whether they would need to be suspended and excluded. That's not what we do. Our full mandate is to look at the learning side and how we can make improvements. So, very similar to the sort of models you use in your industries, this is our reporting and learning cycle. This is what we try to do, identifying the hazards, looking at them, developing the mitigation strategies, and asking the question of, have we done anything? Has it worked? And how do we collect incidents? Well, it is a voluntary system. It's not mandatory, and it's confidential. One thing that we do is we screen everything, that so names of individual people, whether patients or staff, are taken off. There is a case that we can identify the trust, but that's it, really. We now proudly can admit we have over 4 million reports, and that's one thing that really makes it very valuable in terms of learning. It covers all the sectors, so primary care, you name it, it's got the lot, and we'll talk a bit more about how the severe incidents and the deaths are reviewed and scrutinised in further detail. And this is the system. So it comes in from three different routes. We have STICE reports, which are, I have to even look this up, Strategic Executive Information System. That's from local risk management. And the others come directly from staff. We do have self-reports. We have lots of self-reports. We even have a web page for patient reports. So should any of you or family members want to report something, you can do it. We accept them from everywhere. And we do accept them. We do treat them in exactly the same way, whether they were self-reported, whether they were patients. They all get put into the same database. We have 4 million reports, as I said, and in terms of the difference between industries, again, what is an incident? I mean, this something is often a lot more clear-cut looking at other industries. And, for example, if you think of the sensitivity of, for example, a mental health case, if a health visitor goes to visit a patient with mental health problems and they're turned away at their door, that we would consider an incident. You might say there's no harm, there's nothing actually happened. But if later that patient committed suicide, then obviously there would be consequences. So it's a lot softer and more sensitive. I mean, I doubt if any of you had a meeting where somebody didn't turn up, you would consider it an incident. For us, it might be. So it gets reported anyway. So being that we have this large amount of data, we're in a good position of breaking it down. This is 1 year's data, and what you can see is, you know, it's increasing. You know, we see this as a good culture. We try to tell the healthcare this is a good thing. It doesn't mean you're getting worse. It means you're reporting more. And these are how we would split them in terms of sectors. As you can see, a majority come from the acute sector. Very, very few come from general practice. It's a difficult system to actually encourage. It's very fragmented in terms of how it's managed, and you know, we're getting there, we're involving them, we're really talking to them very directly about, you know, the value that this can bring to them. And these are the types of incidents. And I realized after I'd printed this, I'm so delighted this is in a large room, because I realized I'd commit the immortal sin of human factors in producing a slide that had very small font. So apologies at the back, but the biggest section is patient accident, which would be like slips and trips. It's not slips and trips in the simple sense of the word. Sometimes it might be the case of a short-sighted person in a wheelchair decided they needed to go for a smoke and they drove their wheelchair down the stairs. That would be a patient accident. That was a patient accident. And these are actually the original reported results. I say original reported because they're not actually consistent. Obviously, when you've got a wealth of different reporters with different skills and different opinions, what people consider severe harm and what people consider no harm can actually be very, very different. Again, it seems to be really positive that so many are no harm. This means that staff are clearly seeing the relevance, importance of learning for things where there aren't harm. However, sometimes severe harm has to be, you know, recoded downwards, in that actually there wasn't any harm, and it just, somebody thought it was very important and that we should know, so they'd coded it up. We do have that problem, so. And something that's often not appreciated and obviously not seen from our publications, when we hit the media, it's normally about how the statistics, the numbers, how many, I mean, again, something that you would all be suffering, it's how many incidents, whereas what we really get value out of is the actual text. I mean, this is actually possibly quite a typical example in that it doesn't say a lot of the detail, but you can almost see the emotion sometimes of the people who've written them. Sometimes we'll have pages and pages of the description and we have to plow through it. Sometimes we have to go back to the trust, as in that's the only identifiable factor, and say, do you know about this? Can you give us more information? Because we can't make any sense of it whatsoever. And sometimes you can see it's just a passionate cry for help, in that, for example, there weren't enough staff to support a particular situation. But this is what's really valuable in our database, because this, in our 4 million reports, is searchable. And we'll get to that. So. So this is what we do with our incidents. We get about 1,500 incidents coming through into the system per month. And these, for the ones that are reported as death and severe, these are reviewed by our team of clinical reviewers. So these are usually people with risk management and clinical expertise. And they, you know, when it's complicated, they'll get together as a team and make a decision on whether it needs to be seen in more detail. Then these also come from different routes. They don't need to be incidents. Sometimes we get reports of audits or interesting positive things that people have found that they want to put through our system and have discussed at a sort of multidisciplinary level. And so about 50 of these are considered in a weekly response group. And this is a multidisciplinary team of about 20 people. I sit within the group, or another human factors person, and we look at incidents in all their depth. 20 of these are followed up with mini scopes, so that would involve full searches of database, searches outside in literature, in the research literature. Sometimes we will go to a full scope, and then we would be contacting relevant outside stakeholders, involving professional bodies who might be concerned of this. And one would come out as what we term a rapid report, rapid response report. So that's our quick system. And if you can imagine how long that would take, it's not always as quick as you'd like it to be. But these are some of the other products that we'd come up with. It's not just the rapid response report, that's just the quickest. And some of these are longer and have gone into more depth to produce things, or they don't necessarily have to respond to a trigger incident like the first process. And these are some of the examples of the things we've done that have been in collaboration with professional bodies, just to show the genuine complexity of how healthcare has to work, because obviously you know all too well, if you upset one stakeholder, then that's it, you've ruined everything for life. And this is an example of one of the ones that was ended up in a rapid response. So we had a trigger incident, a patient died. We looked through the RS database for similar issues, similar problems. We got a few incidents from MHRA, who are the regulatory authority for medical devices. However, they do not look at design of devices, and that's one thing that's a bit of a problem. Then we go back to the trust for more information, and then we identify learning points. And we produced a rapid response report that's in collaboration with lots of the other relevant bodies. So where are the challenges in terms of this process? One challenge you probably also experienced, and that's the issue of underreporting. Even with our 4 million reports, we know there is massive underreporting. Priority setting is a big problem. For example, if you get an incident and it describes a death, obviously it's very emotive and it might be the only death. It might be a death that has much learning to be occurred. It might be a death of somebody who was inevitably going to die and there wasn't any learning from it and there was actually nothing you can do in terms of safety. It's just a tragic occurrence and very sad for the family and anyone involved. So priority setting is very difficult. You have to really look at where you can look at actual safety benefits and try and put this in. Really, if you ask the question, you know, would I be happy for myself to be treated this way, or would a parent be treated in this way, then that answers the question, and then you look at what you would do next. So, yeah. Again, we have to go back through the professional bodies because often the actions come through for them. So what are the biggest challenges? Extracting what's important, what are the big issues? From an emotive report, that can be quite difficult. And again, like your industries, it relies on events being reported. We can't do anything if they don't report. We had a meeting this week with an ambulances body, and they said, well, we know the issues, so we don't see why we should tell you about them. And this was quite alien to think about. And you know, I had to ask the question, well, are you doing anything about these issues? Well, we're thinking about them. So, you know, it's a case of when we know we can do things, it's very difficult sometimes to encourage others to recognise that and pass that on to their staff. So, in terms of where we're going next, yes, we have to do a lot more embedding of human factors, the awareness, and engaging staff to try and encourage reporting. We have currently trialling specialty reporting, which again might be something different for your industries, but specialties see themselves as very different. If you spoke to a surgeon and an anaesthetist and said, yes, you can all use the same system, you're practically the same, you'd probably get beaten up. So we have GP reporting system that's different from any other reporting, and we're trying to engage with that sensitivity and get things right for them. Data mining. Obviously, because we're late to the game, we've been able to set up our databases with our 4 million reports to allow text mining. And I'm pretty proud to say that we're now being approached by other industries asking them to search them for generic things. We were asked this week for information on dropping objects. And obviously, from our perspective, that means surgeons dropping scalpels or bits of technical kit, and they want to, I can't tell you what industry they are, but they want to know for their own benefits what they could get out of our database. So we're particularly proud about that after being such a laggard. And obviously human factors impact on each part of the process. We look at it in terms of the analysis. Obviously there are very few human factors professionals in healthcare, and it's a case of pointing out to those doing root cause analysis or incident investigation, yes, you can commit errors too. Because it's so specialised, it's not unreasonable for the only doctor available to do an incident investigation to be from a particular area and then judge another by their standards. And so if you had a geriatrician who was being judged by an anaesthetist in terms of how their medication practice, it would actually be quite inappropriate because they might have very different experiences. So we have to educate our analysts in terms of what human factors play a part in their work, just as much as the people they are judging. And obviously in terms of equipment design, whether it is poor design, a lot of healthcare equipment is poor. And you know, for example, it doesn't give good user feedback in terms of, for example, oxygen cylinders that are running out. It's not anywhere near as well-defined as, for example, diving gear. So you actually, in a hospital, you might not know you've got no oxygen in your cylinder before you were actually going to start using it. This is quite scary, but that's healthcare. Sorry. And you thought flying was scary. So obviously we need to bring human factors into the solutions. We need to look at how equipment is designed, as well as environmental design of hospitals, putting things in the right place to make it helpful and make it easy for people who have obviously very high workloads. We're looking at training education. I have absolute sympathies with other people who've been talking about the idea of engaging people with simulators, because healthcare makes a very big thing about how it's got these new fabulous surgical simulators. And I've regularly been there, I've been on the tour, and I've asked how often these are used other than demonstrations for people on tours, and they said, well, actually, we don't. And so they've spent millions on these things, and they don't have an agenda for when they're used, what they're used for. So any learning experiences would be really, really useful for us. Protocols and checklists. Healthcare's got into checklists in a big way. We've got our surgical checklist endorsed by the World Health Organization. So it's really going down that pathway, and obviously we're not going to stop it being that it's a great start, but obviously there are always cautions with checklists. And supporting the whole just culture that we're talking about so much today. And, you know, in many ways, I think that is something we do focus on. We do make as a starting point for most of the things we do. So I think we have a good hope in there, but we have such difficulty in terms of validating what was Harold Shipman and what was a pure accident of somebody who had a terrible day. It's very, very difficult. And so what we want to do for the front line is look at education for staff. We have our Foresight programme, but healthcare has very much jumped on the aviation bandwagon, and now we're in the danger of them making human factors and teamwork completely synonymous. So when people have had team training, they will actually say, we don't need any human factors, we've had that now, so we're fine. And this is actually quite a dangerous message that is coming through to the clinical staff. All the other things you know so well with implementation, getting everyone involved, and that's incredibly sensitive in healthcare because everybody is so specialised. And really, the issue of validation, we can't say things have been made safer, and we don't have these other independent measures that are strong enough to convince clinicians who like to see numbers. So, yes, we're still learning, and we're still going to be looking to the rest of you to carry on learning. So please keep it up. And thank you.